we'll see what develops that. I don't know how.
Okay, we're gathered here today. Today is April the 19th, 2008. I'm gathered here with John Kramer and Mary Battenfield, and we're going to talk about the Kramer-Baird-Erickson family history, as far back as we have living memory, and all the really, the great events of y'all's lives. So to begin, Mary, would you state your full name as it would be on like a birth certificate and in legal documents, so in future years people would know exactly who you are, and your birthday, please?
Anna Mary Kramer Battenfield. I was born October 18th, 1921.
John?
Well, I'm John Henry Kramer, and my great-grandfather was John Henry Kramer. He was a Methodist minister and also a medical doctor. And there was a generation in there that missed the John Henry Kramer factory name, but I was born back in Missouri, April 7th, 1919, so that makes me old.
Well, I wouldn't say that.
Well, I think Methuselah probably still think you were a young pup.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I was reading in the paper this morning something about some lady that was celebrating her 115th birthday, and people are getting older.
That's old.
See? And remember, as we speak, try and add just a little extra octave to your voice like this, and remember where the recorder is sitting, so if you can, maybe direct your voice straight ahead or not turn your head away from the recorder, you know, as we speak.
Yeah.
Well, as you all grew up, what was your life like? What part of Missouri did you live in? Was it country or the city? And what kind of conveniences did you have? Describe your house.
Well, we were out in the country, about 7 miles west of Beauregard, Missouri.
Well, what was that again?
Beauregard, Missouri.
Oh, Beauregard, okay.
Yeah, B-O-G-A-R-D. And we eventually graduated there from the high school after we moved in later on.
Was it a large high school?
No, it wasn't.
Tell
it was eight. When I graduated, there was eight in my senior class. So I'm the only one left in that I know of. And I graduated in 1937. And a few months later, was I after my dad's family had, all of my dad's family moved to Texas, down here in the Rio Grande Valley in 1921, in the McAllen area. And then they dispersed from there and went all over the valley. And one of them, an uncle of mine, came back to Missouri, him and his wife. And he had bone cancer or something, and he had a leg. What's his left leg? Taken off, I think. Yeah,
remember which one?
And he came back there, and he was a farmer.
Hey, John, let's make a note of that story, and let's go back to your early childhood right now. Let's finish talking about that, and we absolutely will get back to that.
Well, we lived, and then this house was a two-story, and not too well insulated, and it was cold in the wintertime. I'll get on to you back then.
Uh-huh.
They had cold winters.
How'd you heat it?
And we just had a stove downstairs.
Wood-burning stove?
Wood-burning stove, coal-burning stove.
Uh-huh.
And fireplaces.
And what?
Fireplaces.
Oh, yeah, we had a fireplace. Yeah.
Did you have one upstairs?
No.
So the heat just had to filter up.
Heat upstairs, it had to filter up. And we slept upstairs. And in the wintertime, we just bundled up in a lot of covers.
Uh-huh.
Sure. And wanted to go to the outhouse, well, and then you had to go outside, except in the wintertime when you'd have a porta potty. I mean,
Talking about a chamber pot or a night jar, a thunder pot, yeah, thunder mug. Thunder mug, okay, that's a good one. That's a good one. Did you have electricity?
No electricity until we moved in. Everything was kerosene lamps, and we had a rail lamp that had the mantle on it. And if you didn't handle it just right, why, the mantle would disintegrate, and then you'd have to put on a new one and get it burned out right, and then start over again. But later on, we had the gasoline lanterns, or lamps, rather, right before we moved to Bogart. And,
do you remember the first radio we had?
Yeah, that's way back there when one set of earphones with it. And
it was a crystal set then.
Yeah, I guess you might call it that. It would run off the storage battery. And it was that's about the only entertainment we had other than going to Sunday school and church. And of course, my mother played the piano, and she always playing music for us, for kids to go to sleep with at night. And there's certain songs that we listened to, you know, like for everybody had their preference of what they liked. She'd play it for us at night and get us to go to sleep. Things like that. And we'd go to church on Sunday. Most of the time we went, that I can recall. And
what kind of car did you have?
Well, we had an old Model T Ford first day. And most of the time, I remember when I was just a little old kid, that 4, 5, 6 years old, I always traveled around in a wagon, a big wagon.
A horse-drawn wagon.
Horse-drawn wagon and team of two horses. In the wintertime, well, we had, when it was snow on the ground, and which happened quite a bit back in those days back there, we had a sled. I don't know when they got rid of that thing. But it was it had a wooden box on, just about like a wagon. And steel runners in front, or iron they were, just cast iron runners in front and runners in the back. You don't remember that?
I don't remember that.
What was the summer like? I mean, without air conditioning, how hard was it to endure the heat?
Well, you just sweat, I guess. But back then, kids didn't worry too much about that. It didn't seem to bother us until we got into town. And that was during the Depression years, back in the 30s. Early 30s, we moved into town. But out in the country, I know a lot of times my dad we'd go into, come into Bogart to shop and get the groceries and staples, flour and sugar and things like that that you needed, and coffee. And of course, we always butchered in the fall and had kill hogs, calves, and cattle, one thing and another, and cured the meat and had a smokehouse. And
oh, really?
Cured the hams and make sausage. I don't know, we didn't make the sausage ourselves. We turned it, somebody else made the sausage. I can't remember who it was. All the neighbors pitched in. When it come time, we'd go from first one place, they wouldn't, to another, and everybody pitched in, helped. That took the family butcher there, what animals they wanted to preserve the meat. And they'd kill 3 or 4 hogs and a calf or two, and they'd cut it all up and salt it down or hang it up in the smokehouse.
Okay, well, when you're talking about this brings up the question of refrigeration. I mean, how did you keep things cold or keep things from spoiling back then?
Well, we had ice box.
Okay.
And that's what I still call a refrigerator. Before I think It's an icebox, that's what I grew up with.
I go, Emerald says, to you, that's a refrigerator.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, how did you, when you butchered all these animals, you'd have a large quantity of meat. And this, did you smoke this? Because just keeping it on a block of ice wouldn't keep it good very long.
Yeah. No, they'd smoke most of it then.
Cure it.
And we distributed it out, and there was, they had a cooler, a freezer, I think, down in Carrollton. If I'm mistaken, they may have taken a lot of it down there, some of it.
So you're saying someone like in town had a freezer then, and you would like, and people would smoke their own meats and then store them somewhere and bring them home as they needed them,
yeah. They would do that.
Well, let me ask you a question. You talk about living out in the country and all these animals and what you did. Was this actually a farm? Tell me what your daily life, if this was a farm, and what your daily life was like up until you got out of high school. I mean, did you get up? Did you have chores to do? And if so, what were they? Tell us about what your actual daily life was like.
Well, when I grew up was big enough to go down in the field and help my dad. Why, I'd ride on the cultivator with him, one thing or another like that, and then...
These were motorized, gasoline-powered?
No, everything was horse-driven.
Horse-driven, okay.
Everything was horse-driven. And a lot of times, we'd go out and when we were shucking corn or snapping corn, why, the team was trained to just poke along, and he'd be on one row, and I'd be on another. And we just, in the fall, go down through the field and strip off the corn, throw it into the wagon, and had a big, one side of it had the wagon box built up high where you could throw it in there and then hit the bump board, so to speak, and fall into the wagon.
Like a basketball backboard.
Yeah, something like that.
Okay.
That's what they call it, the bump board, or the bang board.
I remember the old two horses they had, Bill and Pete.
Yeah, and then they had Pete and Doc, and all of them, every animal, the horses, I had a name. I don't know about the cows, but we had several cows. And I did there a few years before we moved into town, that I'd get out there and help milk, and I'd milk two or three cows of a night. I didn't do too much in the morning, but... My dad would get up there and milk. And we had a container we'd pour all this milk in there and save the cream.
Separator.
Separator, yeah, but it wasn't a...
Talking about an old-fashioned churn, or?
We churned the butter, and, we didn't.
And we separate the cream from the milk.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And then we feed the whey, or what's left over, to the pigs.
So how many animals would you have on this farm? I mean, like a cow, sheep, chickens, goats, I mean, just kind of like...
Well, I don't know, they'd be...
goats or sheep.
Six, we didn't have any goats or sheep, but there were five or six horses. And one time we had a pair of expanded mules, big mules. And I don't know, we didn't keep them too long, they were kind of unruly.
Yeah. Okay, did y'all have, how close were your neighbors, and did you have, like, playmates or people your own age, or was it mostly just a close family unit because people weren't close by, or?
Well, we'd,
Not that you, I'm not trying to say you were antisocial, I mean, just like maybe distance.
Yeah, well, the distance was, what, about a half mile, or?
Probably.
Three quarters of a mile, something like that, to the nearest neighbor. Down north, there wasn't anything south for a couple of miles.
And what kind of road connected you? Was it a dirt road?
Everything was dirt road back then. I can't remember any paved roads, or I mean caliche roads. They were rock. That's the first.
You had to get out and drag the roads, remember?
Yeah, get out. smooth them up when the...
Dig the ditches out so the water could run.
Of course, it's pretty hilly back in there where we live. Not real hilly like it is up in here, but pretty unlevel.
Well, how many children were in your family total?
Well, there was...
You with their names and birthdays? Or?
Well, Mary, you might remember. How many there was?
Well, there was five of us in the end, but...
Yeah. We had a sister that died in 1924, I guess it was.
Was that Emma
Lou?
No, Elizabeth.
Elizabeth, that's right. Okay, all right. Elizabeth, yes.
Her name was Martha Elizabeth, and she was born...
16. I think it was 16.
Then another sister, Emma Louise, was born...
1918.
John was born in...
In 19.
John Henry the third or fourth. And then I was born in October 1921. I was Anna Mary Kramer.
Well, there, you're...
And then Harry.
Bob was... my brother Bob lives in Florida now. He was born in...
November.
Yeah, November...
10th.
The 10th in...
1930.
30, that's right, yeah.
And Harry was born in June
35, I think. 35, well, long in there somewhere.
Okay. And he passed away from lung cancer, did you tell me that?
Yeah.
Okay. Lung cancer.
He was 54.
54.
84. I mean, he was 54.
Oh, yeah, 54 years of age, yeah.
Uh-huh.
That's right, yeah.
And your sister that passed away, I think I remember you having told me that she died of appendicitis.
Yeah. That was the first one. She died back in, she was born in 1918, but she died in 24, something like that. Appendicitis. We lived out in the country before they could get her to the doctor. Appendicitis, they ruptured it before they, the only place they could take care of her was in Kansas City, and that's about 60 miles away, wasn't it? 40. About 40.
Something. By dirt road.
Well, till we got to Carrollton, the dirt road to Carrollton.
They could go on the trains. They could go to Carrollton to take the train to Kansas City.
And of course, these were the days before penicillin.
Oh yeah, definitely. That's back in 1924.
And her appendix burst before they could get her to the doctor. So she died of whatever caused from that.
Yeah.
What a sad thing. We take so for granted drugs like penicillin now. I know in my family, several, you know, we've had children pass away from things, you know, back in the early 20s, just like you're saying. That I had who would have been an uncle of mine who passed away from an ear infection, that a shot of penicillin would have fixed him up just fine. And how sad it was that the things we take for granted today were not available then.
Yeah. And even so, thinking along that line, my younger son passed away. He was 32 years old. He was born in 19 as Gary John Kramer. And he was born in 1954, November the 10th, 1954. And he was born, he weighed, 4 pounds and something like that?
I think so.
4 pounds and 7, 8 ounces, something like that. Just barely was there, and he was pretty small for a long time, but he had the pituitary problem. And over the years, we started taking him after the doctors in the valley, kind of gave up on him. They didn't know what to do. We started taking him to the to Galveston, to the John Seeley Hospital up there, and then he got into the research department where it didn't cost us hardly anything except a trip up there and back. And 1 year, I don't remember what year it was, We made 13 trips to Galveston from Rio Hondo, where we live, my wife and I. Dale, our older son, he would go with us a lot of times when we'd go up on the weekends, take him up or go see him or whatever, where he happened to get, Gary happened to be in. Then he had night blindness, had retinitis pigmentosa, and when it got dark, he couldn't see unless he had a light. And he had no peripheral vision, and he couldn't see things out of sight. He couldn't see. And he couldn't ride a bicycle or anything like that to where you had your stability, you might say. So,
what year did you... Continue.
Well, he was pretty much incapacitated like that. And then his eyes started going bad on him. We took him to Austin, and he went through the school for the blind. Up there, he learned what he was learning. Braille. He was learning that, but anyhow, he got where he could get around in the dark pretty good, just by using that white stick that they carry, you know. And they taught him how to do that. He wasn't completely blind, but he was legally blind. There in the end, his inner organs started to fail, and they was competing with each other, and they never could figure it out exactly what it was that he died of, but they thought it was the meningitis. They thought that was what it was, but they did an autopsy, but they couldn't pin anything down. He had so much wrong with him.
Let's say, what year was this now?
1985.
Okay.
Yeah.
And he was how old?
When he was 32.
And he died 32.
Yeah.
Okay. What year did your parents pass away? What years?
Well, my dad's folks, after I came down to the Valley in 1937, and Mary came, and my older sister Liz came down in 19.
Well, he said, when did they die?
Oh, yeah. Well, let me get that. My dad died in 1969.
We were young.
No, I mean, not 60.
He was 60 years old. 65 years old.
Yeah, he was 69. I think he was.
Excuse me.
Okay, what year was that again?
What was it? 1959, wasn't it? 1959?
Was he born in 1890?
Yeah.
Well, if he was 69 and he was born in 1890, then he would have passed away in 1959.
Yeah. Well, that's right, yeah.
And how about your mom?
And then she
died November the 10th.
No, it's
after Thanksgiving Day.
Thanksgiving Day.
Her birthday was November. She was born in 1889.
She was 96 years old when she passed away.
She was 96, I figured that out.
Okay, help me. She was 96 years old, and she passed away when? What year?
In 85.
In 85, well, in that case, then she would have been born in 1889. Yeah, all right.
Yeah, she was born in 89. I thought she died in 84.
Well, in that case, you know, she outlived your dad by 30 years. Where did she continue her life after that? Was she still in the old family homestead? Or?
Yeah, my sister Liz, that worked for Sears and Roebuck for years and years and years down there. She never married, and she and my sister Liz and my mother lived together for several years, and then my sister had somebody to come in and stay with my mother while she was working. And then when my sister Liz retired, she spent full time taking care of our mother.
Uh-huh.
Until she passed away, and then my sister Liz moved up here with Mary several years later.
About three or four years with me.
Okay. Well, now let me ask you...
But this was in Harlingen where they lived.
Okay. Let's jump backwards in time a little bit, back to, you know, when you're growing up at the, this is your pre-high school graduation days. What other family members did you have in terms of aunts, uncles, grandparents? Now, bear in mind that your children have no living memory of many of these people. Tell me who these people were that were around all the time, who influenced your life, and what things would you like to be remembered about them? What personality traits they had, what values they had, where you learned the values that made you who you are, and the values of the time, and what you would like to talk about, what you would like to tell your descendants, you know, like way down the road, years and years from now, about the values then versus the values now. I mean, elaborate on those things, if you would.
Well, there was, in my dad's family, he was the only one, and all there after.
Was he an only child, or?
No, he was one of seven.
Oh, I see.
Okay.
And all the rest of them had moved to Texas, like I say, in 1921. Uh-huh. And he was the oldest, therefore he had a family. And so he stayed put back in Missouri. And then my mother, she was one of eight, wasn't it?
I think there were seven, I think.
Oh, seven or eight, I can't remember. Too many of them. We was looking at it in a picture of that while ago. But... some of them lived right close there in Bogart when we were going to high school. And we
out on the farm, on the farm though, and Beavers and Aunt Ann were the
and then
helpers.
Grandpa and Grandma Erickson, my mother's family, mother and dad, they lived in Bogart, and we go and see them occasionally, and my grandmother. Grandma, we called her Grandma Erickson. She was blind, completely blind, had she had glaucoma when she was in her middle age, so to speak, and they had to take both eyes out. They did that back then, and she was blind for several years.
That's the only way I remember her.
Yeah, that's
she always wore little black glasses.
She and she smoked a little clay pipe every once in a while. We'd go in there when I was just a kid, a younger kid, but I'd help tamper put the tobacco in her pipe. And a lot of women did that back in those days, they say. But that was unusual. I remember that.
Well, tell me what Christmas and Thanksgiving were like. I mean, those had to have been, when you have a rural life like that, those had to have been big holidays. I mean, what would you do for those holidays? Was it a big family meal? The relatives come from a ways around where you all got together? And, well, tell me about those holidays.
They didn't do that too awful much. Back then, it didn't seem like that. No. Not on the farm, of course, back after we moved into
the morning and open presents.
Yeah. We'd go out in didn't have forest, just little timberlands, or brush along the creeks, first one thing and the other. They'd cut a tree down and bring it in, and with no leaves on anything, just limbs, and we'd decorate it all up with popcorn strings of popcorn and
paper.
Yeah, paper chains and tinsel and first one thing like that. And then, of course, back then we all believed in Santa Claus.
Yeah.
What was the most memorable thing you ever got for Christmas?
Well, I remember that that sled. I can't remember the name of the thing now. Ooh, that was something else.
I remember going down the hill to the windmill.
Oh, yeah.
snow and something.
Well, tell us about that. You know, that's, was there a lot of snow, you know, in the winter time? Yeah, what did you do?
The time we had a lot of snow. Uh-huh. Back then, it seemed like it snowed in before Thanksgiving. And
how cold did it normally get? I mean, it's...
Well, the coldest I remember is about 18 to 20 below zero there. And,
well, that's cold.
I mean, that's cold.
Yeah, no doubt about that. It's
real cold.
And,
I think it...
Of course, I had a... I inherited these clamp-on skates that my dad had when he was younger.
Ice skates?
Ice skates, yeah. And we would go around the people, everybody, all the farmers back in the rural area there had ponds. And they'd freeze over in the wintertime, we'd go skating on them. Some of them weren't very big, some of them were pretty good size. But everybody would get together, seemed like on weekends, and certain nights, one thing doesn't go out there and build a bonfire long out on the ground somewhere. And somebody with that wasn't skating would keep that going. Well, yeah, all the rest of us get out there and skate. That's after we moved to town. But I remember in the winter of...
I never got to do that.
You never did do that? You didn't have any skates. I don't know. But,
we didn't want to feed the fire then, I guess.
I mean, I had to feed the fire.
I remember in the winter of 1932, after we moved to town. No, it wasn't. Yes, it was, too. In the winter of 32, it snowed and snowed, and it was pretty deep, and then it kind of melted some, and then it froze over again, and it sleeted on top of that, and then that froze and melted a little bit, and then everything was a solid skim of ice over everything instead of snow. And we got down on skates, so boys had skates, and we'd get down, we'd skate around all over the whole dang country.
Oh.
You can't believe miles that we went, and we get down in the place where there wasn't any ice or snow and scare up a rabbit and get him out on the ice and then chase him down, and we'd bat him around the first one place and the other. He couldn't eat. The rabbit had no traction on solid ice.
Uh-huh.
But we was on skates, so we had fun chasing the rabbits down like that. That was quite a sport. That only happened one time that I remember. And that was something else.
That does sound like fun.
I've told that to several different kids, and they couldn't believe that.
Well, hey, what kind of values did y'all raise? I mean, as I have met your family and gotten to know you all, you're a great group of people. I like hanging out with you. And like, what do you think that is? I mean, like, what kind of values did y'all grow up with that made you a cohesive family like that?
Oh, I don't know. We all went to everybody liked music. Seems like
I said,
one thing.
Did everybody play or?
Well, Mary does, and then Liz, our sister Liz did, and of course my son does. But my mother played. And she taught music and taught piano and all that stuff, and she was a real artist when it comes to the piano.
She could play by ear too.
Huh?
She could play by ear too.
Oh yeah.
Anything she knew, like I can.
And we all grew up going to church as early as I can remember, and she was...
In what denomination?
We went to the Methodist church.
Methodist, okay. Yeah.
Our two great-grandfathers were both Methodist ministers, so we were born Methodist.
Yeah.
We never quit.
Yeah. Okay.
And I think there was never any liquor in our house or that I could ever remember when we were growing up.
No.
I mean, hard liquor.
I can't remember of any.
My dad did smoke. He smoked a pipe and then later...
Cigars.
Oh, forever. And then later cigarettes. That probably was what killed him because he died of a heart attack. But I don't know that.
Yeah.
They were just good parents. I'm butting that on yours, but...
No, you fill in. wherever you can. But.
Well, it sounds like you all had an upbringing to where you really didn't have the outside influences coming in, like television, radio. You kind of had to entertain each other. You spent a lot of time with each other, and you had to get along with each other.
Yeah, well, we did pretty much, except that I was quite a tease, according to her. My sisters, they had cut out paper dolls, and they'd have them on the floor. I'd come along.
Long cat was going to move all the way. And I used to chase him. I threw a paring knife at him. I thought that's a good one.
Okay, well, that sounds interesting.
That's the only time I ever got whipped, I think, that I can remember. But luckily it missed him and hit a glass in the medicine cabinet, remember there?
Oh, yeah.
And broke the glass. And I don't know whether it was because I threw the knife, of course.
I don't remember
what you did, but I was so mad at them.
Still lived on the farm. My dad was trimming a bunch of trees around in the yard, burrage, and may have brought some up out along the fence line anyhow, and throwed them out in a pasture, not in the pasture, but across the fence in the lane it was that came up from the pasture. And had a pretty good brush pile there, so we set it on fire and burned it. And it made it was 15 or 20 feet around, and it all burned down to just kind of a white ash. And we all, most of us, were barefooted back in those days for a long time. And she was barefooted, so she gets the idea of walking out through that, and then knowing that was red hot. And
you remember what we were doing, though? That reason I cut across, Shorty?
No.
We were going swimming in this great big horse tank, you know, as wide as this.
Oh, and I had shoes on.
Yeah, and he had shoes on, so I followed him to go to the tank to go swimming.
Ah!
And I burned my feet.
Oh, boy, and I ran out in there and grabbed her up, because I knew what it was like. And got her out of there. But she had burned feet there for several weeks before they healed up.
How old were you when that happened?
Must have been about five.
Yeah, four or five.
Four or five. Something like that.
I see.
Should have been old enough, maybe three or four. Yeah. I don't remember. I was old enough to know better, probably, but I thought it didn't look redder. Oh, yeah, we used to go round and around, and John would tease me because I was younger. But other than throwing the paring knife at him, I put up pretty well, tolerated him. Less than step in.
Chase me with a broom or flash water or something like that. And when we was out there in the country back in the 20s, why, after all the family kind of grew up, boy, we could look after ourselves and get around without somebody helping us. Why, we'd go to Carrollton, was it every Thursday night? They had a band concert down there. So we load everybody in the car at the time, and we had a reel. Uh-huh. Open reel. It wasn't enclosed in or anything, just a cloth top. And in the wintertime, we had side curtains put on. But anyhow, in the summertime, we'd fall on. We'd go down to Carrollton in the Carrollton, Missouri, to the band concert, and we'd listen to that, and then we'd go by the ice house when we left town. And
didn't they get 100 pounds?
Huh?
Didn't they get 100 pounds?
Yeah, we'd get a 100-pound chunk of ice, and that was the refrigeration we had.
Put it in the ice box
for a whole week, and if we was lucky, we'd have a little piece left.
And it was always my job to empty, you know, it drained down into a pan of water.
Uh-huh.
And that was always my job. I had to empty the water under the ice box drain.
And it was my job to empty the slop jar of the Thunderbird.
Oh, no. Boy, how'd you get that? You must have been cutting up to get that job.
Well, I was older and got outside, I guess. I knew where to dump it, and then we'd cover it up with dirt.
Liz was old enough to order us all around.
Yeah, she was.
She was 5 years older than I was. Of course, John and Emma were in between. So. But.
That sounded like a real interesting upbringing. I think that we pretty well covered, you know, your time up to when you get out of high school. So right now I'm going to pause the recorder and let's decide what we want to talk about next. And I see you got a couple of notes about things you want to say. When we come back, I'd like to move into your early adulthood lives, you know, like your experiences as a very young man in World War II and what that was like, and your experiences, Mary, when you first left home and had friends serving in the war and that sort of thing, and early marriage years, and then you can talk about the years that Bill spent chasing wetbacks out of the brush. And but we'll pause right here and then come back to that in just a minute.
Wayne there, from
John, I know from past conversations with you that you had quite some experiences in combat and in World War II. Now, in quick addition in my mind, I think you must have been 24, 25 years old on Pearl Harbor Day, December 7th, 1941. How old were you?
Well, that's right. Right. That was, 1942 when I got to Pearl Harbor. Of course, I wasn't there when the actual attack happened, but I was on the West Coast. I'd been in the Army about 3 months. I got in September, October, November. Got in the Army about 3 months. Making $21 a month.
$21 a month?
Yeah, that was the going pay for a private then. And we...
You were 21 then when you went in.
Was that 20? Yeah, I guess it was. Yeah.
Born 19, you went in 41.
Yeah.
Okay, you're 21 years old. Still a very young man.
Yeah. And we trained out in, I was sent to San Diego, California, right along the coast, above La Jolla, California, and right close to San Diego, and I was trained there for about 3 months. And in winter, in fall and winter, after December the 7th, when that happened, everything was foggy and wet and cold. And they run us out on the coast, not knowing what to expect, because nobody knew anything then. And we had World War I helmets, the old flat.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
And 1903 Springfield rifles, that's all we had. And no other armament other than 105 millimeter German howitzers that Coast Artillery used back in those days. We never did fire them, but anyhow, we trained on those things. And, I mean, we go out there at somebody run a patrol out along the beach. And we I can't remember how high that bluff was down to the water. It must have been 80 or 90 or 100.
Where was this?
It was a long time.
It's still in Hawaii?
No, this is in California,
above
La Jolla. And after the war started, and we stayed out there in the along the beach at night, along the bluff on top. We sit out there, when it seemed like it rained every night, they'd run me out there on a night patrol with a bunch of them. It'd be 8 or 10 of us. We'd all scattered out. There wasn't any brush or anything there. We tried to get under. We'd take our pup tent out there, but the shelter half, rather. And it wasn't much protection. It soaked through and had a raincoat, but that didn't help much because your helmet didn't protect you much. It run down your neck and everything else, and that was a miserable 2 or 3 months that I'd ever spent. Not standing out there in the dark, not knowing.
But it got worse, didn't it?
Yeah. Well, and then they transferred me to anti-aircraft artillery gun outfit, and we went out in the Mojave Desert out from Barstow, about 40 miles east and north of Barstow, California. And we were out there for
hottest place in the whole world, except you, Maritham.
January, February, March, and April of 42. Then April of that part of April of 42, we left there and went to San Francisco, loaded up everything and went up there to San Francisco, the whole battalion. And we got there and they turned us around and said, no, and not ready to ship you out yet. The orders have been changed, go back to out in the desert again. So we went out there and for another 2 weeks, and then we did the same thing again. We loaded up, went to, back to San Francisco again, and loaded everything on board ship, and we headed out, and we all had, everybody back in those days had OD, which is all the drab wool clothes,
yeah.
Pants, coats, all that stuff, and no khaki or anything like that. And then we figured, well, boy, we're going to Alaska or someplace cold, but they loaded us on the ship with the old President Johnson, freighter, I think it was, the whole battalion, and we headed out until we got about 2 or 3 days out from Frisco. And of course, the thing was zigzagging. Back in those days, there were several other ships along with us.
Zigzagging to make it difficult for submarines to take shots at you.
They didn't know where any of them was or anything back in those days. That's pre-radar
and all radar, there, yeah.
Yeah. And about, of course, after we left the port, well, before we left the port, a lot of them got on board ship, and they lifted anchor and got out in the middle of San Francisco Harbor and dropped anchor. And you couldn't even tell it's moving. There was, I don't know how many dozens of the guys got sick, seasick. And they laid on right close to the railing. It took us 11 days to go from Frisco to Honolulu. And there's a bunch of them that had to take off on stretchers because they hadn't eaten anything. And they'd take them down to the sick bay and help them and everything else till we got over there. I don't know what happened to a lot of them, but they run us, after they load us on the truck after we got to Honolulu Harbor, took us all the way around Pearl Harbor, on circled that, and we wound up on the west side of Pearl Harbor. We out towards the mouth of Pearl Harbor.
What state was Pearl Harbor still in at that time? This was in 1942 when you got there?
Yeah, it was in first part of May, 42.
Okay. There was a great...
Hawaiian territory.
But there was a massive salvage operation going on there.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It was still greatly destroyed from the Japanese attack, wasn't it?
Very much so, yeah.
Talk a little bit about that.
We were stationed right close to the Pearl Harbor for a long time until I was transferred out of the outfit into a headquarters outfit into Honolulu proper.
Aren't you just above all the ships were in?
Well, Fort Shafter, I first went to for several months, and then they transferred me out of that to a headquarters outfit. And I was a message center chief, supposed to do typing, and I'd never taken typing in my life. I don't know where they got the idea that I was a typist. But anyhow, I did that for a spell, after I was transferred from Fort Shafter, we moved up above Aia, a little town right down close to, right on the back end of end of Pearl Harbor, and it was up high, and they built a building that we, the main building where all the headquarters offices and the officers are, that did their meetings in, that we had a, the top part of it was a lookout tower, so to speak, and had several big scopes that we could look right down into Pearl Harbor, not out in the bay, and we'd see Diamond Head and all the other points of interest all around the island. And,
we eventually wound up. You eventually wound up in combat operations, didn't you?
Yeah, eventually. We were there with our outfit, 162nd Operation Detachment. We trained other anti-aircraft artillery troops there for a long time until they decided that several months before the invasion of Okinawa, that's where I wound up. But before that, I had an operation for hemorrhoidectomy. Hemorrhoidectomy, 1943, and that was one of the worst things I'd ever gone through with.
Amen. I'll take to that.
and I had another one in 1952, same thing. But anyhow. In 43, left word 43, 44, something like that, they sent me to Morse Code School, and I learned telegraphy and radio operator, and that's got that all down pat, and had a radio operator's class certification in him. And we boarded when they started to have units picked out to go to Okinawa. Our regiment, or whatever, I don't know how many people was there. I mean, it wasn't a battalion, but they picked out 13 men and four officers, I think, to go down as an advanced bunch to set up our camp and get ready for set up communications and all that sort of stuff. But we were got on board ship and on February, March, early part of February and March, we boarded ship there in Honolulu.
And what year is this?
1945.
Okay.
And we were aboard ship about 2 months before we got to Okinawa, and we sailed around all over the Pacific, seemed to me like. Never did get off. We went down around the Philippines and around Guadalcanal and some of those islands like that that we'd already taken, the United States Army had already taken. And we had to wait for the Marines to finish up on Iwo Jima before they, a bunch of them could come on in and help out with Okinawa. So we were headed up from, I guess, we'd been down close to the Philippines, best I recall. And we ran into a typhoon for about 3 or 4 days. And luckily I had an upper berth. And I never did get seasick all the time when I was aboard ship, coming and going and one thing and another, but a lot of them did, and that was pretty raunchy, I tell you for sure. Guys getting sick, and he wasn't no place to go. He couldn't get outside and get washed overboard. But that was a rough son of a gun, I'm telling you for sure. That boat ride for about 3 or 4 days going through a typhoon. They said we lost some ships, but I never did find out exactly what they were. Some smaller ones, I guess, but before we got to Okinawa, you could see ships everywhere. We were right in the middle of battle wagons, and destroyers, big cruisers, aircraft carriers, and all that sort of stuff.
Well, when you got to Okinawa, had the island been taken yet?
No, that was, we got there on the first day of April 1st. So things got kind of hairy after that.
Well, I'd like you to talk about that to whatever extent you feel comfortable.
Well, we were aboard ship. We didn't go ashore. They wanted to get us ashore, but they didn't have enough boats, I guess, to take us or something. But anyhow, when they come our time, we got off on my birthday. It was on April the 7th. We were aboard ship for about a week there before we went ashore. And we loaded our packs on our back, like it was loaded, like we had. That had everything we needed in our ammunition belt and our rifle. Of course, then I had a, what they called a grease gun. It was an automatic 45 caliber automatic. It looked something like a Tommy gun, only it was just made out of sheet metal. And it's something new that they come up with. It made it pretty light to carry anyhow.
Had a long straight clip, if I remember right.
At 20 rounds in each clip.
And what was your job in your unit?
Well, I was a radio operator.
Uh-huh.
And we were supposed to set up communications. And with all the different anti-aircraft guns, and things got kind of hairy around there about when the kamikaze planes started coming in from Japan. And I was led to get off the port ship. Well, I mean, tell you, there was after a couple of days after we'd landed, got off the ship, a herd went out there and they said a plane, well, I saw where the plane dived into this ship and the first gun battery on the front of the ship, they had, I forgot what, 20 millimeter, something like that, guns that they had, that the Navy had around on them. But a kamikaze dived in there and killed five or six of the boys on that, around that gun. Good thing we got off, because I was running underneath that gun for a long time.
Uh-huh.
Or I wouldn't have been here.
So if you hadn't gotten off the ship when you did, you might well have been killed.
Yes, well, yeah. Of course, some of the guys did. You got hurt down there. Of course, most of us got off at different times, different units, different different times. Some of them got off on the first, some of them got off on the second, third, and fourth. And there was a bunch of Japanese Americans that were going ashore as interpreters, and they were on board ship. There was 8 or 10 of those, and we were just a little bunch of this one, a little bunch of that one, and various and sundry different regiments all aboard that ship, just going in to set up their unit through their headquarters, in other words, so to speak. And our rest of our outfit didn't come down till about the first part of June, something like that. Well, we were there April and May, just 13 guys. And one poor guy, soldiers, got a shelter hat, and it took two of you to put two of them together to make a tent. And one fellow, he didn't have anybody to shelter hat with for a long time till he finally got somebody to donate another shelter hat. We snapped together and make him something. And he was out in the cold, and it rained seeming like there every day there during April and during May and June. And the kamikaze planes would come in, and of course the Navy, we were right pretty close to Kadena Airport and Yontan Airport, and there was name of that river. Little creek, it would have looked to me like. But anyhow, that's where we all landed. And when we finally got off board ship, going back, decided to go ashore our outfit. We had our packs and our rifle and everything. Everybody climbed down that rope, throw it over the side of the ship like you see everybody doing during World War D-Day. And nobody thought anything about that. That's just one way to get off that big boat.
Well, I've seen a lot of film footage, from the Battle for Okinawa. Probably one of the hardest fought battles in World War II. If my memory serves right, we lost around 17,000 people ourselves, and over 100,000 for the Japanese, which was basically all of them because nobody surrendered.
Nobody surrendered. Our outfit was, we were right in about the middle of the island, and of course, we were really non-combatant as far as we weren't set up to be infantry or anything. We're a headquarters outfit, and for communications, and we set up phone lines and all that sort of stuff. We never did get around to.
You didn't get to shoot at anybody.
You might telegraph.
You never shot at anybody.
No, I never did get to shoot at anybody. But I wanted to. There's some planes come down through there, and we had 150 caliber gun in our outfit. I don't know what they figured it, but just had it. Just mounted out there in the middle of that little old space that they gave us there on the island. One of them came down through there, and boy, I ran out there and was going to shoot him. No, the officer said, don't shoot him. Don't shoot at him. You're liable to draw fire. And I said, well, he just keep coming down through here. We might as well get rid of him. Somebody shoot him. Nobody knew how they shoot the dang thing, I don't think. But I had a little practice on one of them. I knew how to fire it and shoot it, but they wouldn't quite let me do it.
I remember after you came back from the war for so long, you never would say anything about your experiences over there.
And then, of course, like when they all the kamikazes started coming in, and they started diving into the aircraft carriers and the battle wagons and things like that. Of course, we could see the battle wagons when they'd shoot, they're shooting 16-inch shells. You could see the projectile. You could trace it for a long ways there before it got out of sight and before it hit land. Way down there, that was on the east end of the island. Naha is where all the casualties happened. And there's the Navy was shooting up stuff, and it had to come down somewhere. And boy, how did we got underneath. There was a cave, and that we got in. When they started really shooting up there, all that, we had picked up chunks of shrapnel that weighed 15 to 20 pounds, some of those big shells that they'd shoot up, and it had to come down. And boy, how it was saturated that island. Their sailboats got hurt like that. But it just, shrapnel come down, and then there was buddy of mine and I had our tent with. We pitched up, pitched our tent right behind they had burial vaults. They'd come digging back into the hill, and they'd go back in there and bury the people, and then they ever so often they'd go in there and clean the body after they deteriorated, and clean the bones and put them in a jar. They was made out of concrete and everything, pretty safe. So whenever that stuff started falling around us, we'd get in there and we opened up the cave or the burial vault and got in there and saved our skin, I'm pretty sure, several times for this. We picked up a lot of that shrapnel right around our outfit. And we pitched our tent right behind this thing, kind of a swale cut out place where the it was rocky, and the water, when it rained, the water would run off. And we had, when we got off board ship, we took some of the canvas cots bottoms that the Navy used for beds. And that was kind of what the beds were made out of. We brought several of those ashore, so we built some racks and sewed them up with telephone line. So we get our bodies up off the ground when it rained, and it seemed like rain there for a long time. It was wet and cold during April and I guess May when it first started clearing up. But
how long were you there on Okinawa?
Well, April, May, and June, they're about 3 months.
And almost 3 months of your life there.
Yeah, sure enough.
Well, maybe not.
And the somebody got to where they hauled Japanese bodies back by our outfit in dump truck. They just throwed them in there. There's so many of them.
Uh-huh.
And they somebody got, boy, they would smell that awful thing and smell you think of. And we got to where somebody's designated all day long to stand out there and watch the road that is coming from the battlefield. And they taking them home, hauling them back west somewhere, and then they buried them in a mass grave. And whenever this fellow that was lookout, he'd hollered everybody into the winds in a different direction. We'd run to the other side of the road till they got by.
Our people are there.
No, they're dead Japanese.
Oh, Japanese.
Yeah. They just gathered up the bodies and they be playing around in the weather, hot weather, warming up. So they had to get rid of
them. That was smelly.
Well, what was it like when they finally dropped the bomb and, you know, the war came to an end? Where were you when you heard about the atomic bomb, and how did everybody react?
It surprised me one day in June the 26th, 1945, they say you've got enough points to go home on a 45 temporary duty and rest and recuperation. And I said, man, I said, I live in Texas and it'll take me a month and a half to get back there, and I'll be back there 45 days, then have to come back here again. I said, I'll do it. several of us, practically everybody except three or four of them didn't. They said, no, they wasn't going to do that. They was just going to stay there. And one fellow lived in Maine, and I wrote to him. He stayed behind, and he wasn't going to go home. So I wrote to him several times there for a while after I got home. But anyhow, I left on June the 26th, and sometime in the latter part of middle of June, it must have been about two or three days after I left, there was a storm came through there, hit Okinawa, and yet this leveled a bunch of things, I'm telling you, wash boats or ships ashore and all that sort of stuff, and regular typhoon, I guess. And that was, met my, then, he wasn't my brother-in-law then, but I met him, I had met him in Hawaii. He was in the Marines, and he was married to my future wife's, he was a sister. He married my wife's.
Was that one of the McEwans?
No, it's Donald Bennett.
Oh, Bennett.
And I'd seen him, met him in Hawaii, and of course I knew him, I'd met him before he joined the Marines, because he came in after I was in the Marines.
Well, then, were you able to not go back to Okinawa? They dropped the bomb while you were stateside.
Well, I was stateside. I came home, I got home, well, let's see, on July 4th, 1945, I was on Saipan.
Uh-huh.
Island in, let's see, Pinian, which was the island right close to Saipan. Of course, we'd already taken those, and I got off the ship docked there, and well, I was on my way home. I got off and went up the hill and found out that my uncle was there, had been stationed there in Seabees. He was a barber at Morgan. Bob Morgan's dad. And got up there and got a hold of the right people and said, no, he's been gone. We've been gone for 2 weeks. He got enough points in their age or something when they shipped him home. And I missed him, so I went back down to the dock and got on board ship. And I could, while I was up there, I could see Tinian. And that was, they would be 5 B-29s take off at one time. It'd be, I think, 2 of them ahead and then 3 of them kind of behind. And they was bombing Tokyo for Japan round the clock. And that was where they left with the atomic bomb. It may have been there then. I don't know when they brought it in. But that's where they left from. And, of course, I went on to Hawaii. And on the way home from there, and back to Frisco, and I've been under the Golden Gate Bridge twice, but never had been over the top of it. My wife and I was going to do that back in the 90s, and I got sick out there. Had a urinary infection out there somewhere in the Yosemite or something. And I had come on home, so we never did get across the bridge. But I got home.
I finally
got back to the States. And I don't remember what day, sometime in July. And it took me, we left, well, it was 11 days, 11 or 12 days from Frisco to San Antonio, Texas. We went up the Sacramento, I forgot what, wherever it was. Well, we went up to Salt Lake City, down to Denver, and all went and on a troop train. And this train was headed for San Antonio.
Uh-huh.
And the train picks up and they haul us so far and then they put us on the siding and next, we'd be there for a whole, maybe 2-3 hours, all day. And then another train come along and pick us up and take us on further. And that's really just took us a dang long to get to San Antonio. And we stopped off at Milano, Texas. And, it's up not too far out of San Antonio. But we were there, I think, 2 days before the troop train came out and picked us up and brought us into San Antonio. Then I was there for 3-4 days before they found my records and got my furlough orders all sealed up and everything, and then got me on the bus and I headed home to Harlingen. And I got in there, I don't know, it was a week or two before they dropped the atomic bomb. I told a bunch of them out. When we left, said, oh, heck, the war's life would be over. I said, I'm going to go on home from Okinawa here. You guys can stay here if you want to. But it'll take 3-4 months before we go home and come back if we have to. Oh, no, the ones that stayed, they regretted it.
Well, to me, it's kind of like a no-brainer. Let's stay here in a place that's hell on earth where you're getting shot at and everything else, or go home. I don't see the big decision there.
Yeah, that was me.
Yeah.
I'm going to get out of this, man. I've been in the service long enough.
That's why you're one of the survivors, too.
You betcha. I was come home, I tell you for sure.
Well, when did you hear about the bomb being dropped, and when did you find out that basically the war was over and Japan was surrendering?
I was there in Harlingen, and I can't remember the exact date or time or anything, but well, of course, everyone realized that things was, that was the end of it.
Uh-huh.
And it was, I just stayed my 45 days that I was allowed, and I got on the bus to San Antonio to Port, what's the name of that big, funny you can't have those names in your mind, and then you want to recall them, can't think of it anyhow.
So when did you finally get your discharge papers? When were you free?
Well, it was the latter part of August. I just lacked about 2 weeks to getting in 4 years, solid years, something like that. But I got up there, and so many of them, of course, after the war was over, there's people coming in there, Fort Sam Houston. Anyhow, but hundreds. And they couldn't find my record, so they could
discharge
Fort Sam.
What year?
45. It's August, latter part of August, 45. I've got a discharge, I mean a certificate.
You write his name down.
A discharge paper in the car, car papers. I know still. I was looking for something in there. I said, "What's this doing in here?" It's coffee, but nevertheless.
Okay, well, this takes us up through your World War II experiences. Let me pause this here right again, and when we come back, I'd like to ask Mary to talk about her experiences, like in young adulthood and up through the war on the home front. So let's take a little break right now. We'll pause, and then we'll come back to that.
I say the computer's still on.
Yeah, I want to listen to what you have to say here, Mary, and chime in.
Okay.
Well, okay, we're back now, and we've heard John's experiences up through the end of World War II. Now, Mary, by my calculation, you would have been probably 21 years old in 1941, in Pearl Harbor Day. You would have just turned 20. Let's see, 1941, you're born in 21. No, you would have just turned 20 years old. Well, shortly after that, and then during the war, you married Byron Bill, Battenfield. I'd like you to describe those days of run-up to the war, what the mood was like in the country, I mean, how people felt when the war started, and what your life was like going through those times in terms of, like, getting things from the store, I mean, Victory Gardens, contributing old pots and pans to the war effort. I mean, I just want you to talk about, first of all, just talk about the major things that you remember, and then we'll go back and kind of fill in the in-between things, and if I see something you're skipping over, I'll probably jump in and ask you to elaborate on something.
Okay. Well, where shall I start? Pearl Harbor Day?
Well, that's fine. Just remember to speak up a little bit.
When you first come to Texas, you might start.
Well, yeah. I came to Texas in the fall of 1939. I graduated from high school that July or whatever. We finished school in June.
June, later part of June.
June.
Yeah.
And I came down in October. And that was in 39 and 41. I met Bill.
And where'd you meet Bill?
Well, I met him on a blind date. A friend of mine was going with a soldier from Brownsville, which was just below Harlingen, and they were in the United States Cavalry and were riding horses. And they brought him up as a blind date, met him in November, and we were married in April the 5th. 1942, and we were out on a date on Pearl Harbor, Pearl Harbor happened. We were riding around, I'll never forget that day, and there was another guy with us, and the two couples of us, and they were selling papers on the street. He said, Pearl Harbor and the war has started, and everybody go to their units, back to their units immediately. Of course, they rolled the window down, threw the paper out, and stayed out till midnight. They weren't going back.
They had a good idea of what they ran for.
Yeah.
And then we were, I met him in November, like I say, we were married the next April. And in the meantime, they had, before then, they had gotten on their horses and ridden over to Louisiana, I think, somewhere on the horses and back.
I mean, they rode from like Harlingen or Brownsville to Louisiana and back. And for anybody listening to this, this is about a 600-mile trip by horseback.
Yeah.
You know, it's 1,200 miles if you go there and back on horseback. So.
Yeah. It was not easy.
I remember seeing there in the valley when I was working with the John Deere people, that the horses, they would go from Brownsville to, they come through Harlingen and go to Rio Grande City, Fort Ringgold, mm-hmm. up there quite often, and we see bunches of them come through Harlingen there.
Yeah.
Occasionally, various hundred times.
Bill started out in El Paso.
Before the war.
And then when he went in, he was drafted. He was working in the oil fields, and he was drafted and went to close to El Paso and then to Harlingen later. Of course, I didn't know him then, but times were tough, and we were married.
Well, you were working for a doctor at the time, weren't you?
Yes, I was working for a doctor. I worked for him for 5 years, even after we were married a little while.
This was the doctor that loaned you his car for your honeymoon.
Right.
Yeah. And that car is in one of the pictures in the family website, too. The Bill is squatting down in front of it. Yeah, I remember that picture.
That was when we were on our honeymoon.
What was it, Lincoln?
I don't remember what kind it was, but it was snazzy.
Yeah. Had a lot of chrome on it, I remember that. It was probably one of the last new cars before the war.
Yeah.
Well, what was it like then, you know, being married, living here stateside during the war? I mean, what was like, how did the war affect life here in the United States, you know, in stateside?
Well, there were a lot of things we couldn't get, like tires, and Dad was working at the Army at Air Base there in Harlingen. We couldn't get cigarettes, and of course all of us smoked, but he was able to get cigarettes at the Air Base. And,
did you get liquor?
Sugar.
Did you get scotch?
Well, I didn't drink anything.
Oh,
no, I take that back. While we were dating, I learned to drink bourbon. Yeah, you could get things like that at the airbase. And well, life was kind of tough. But he was down there until we got married, and he was still in the Army.
Well, he's stationed down there in Brownsville.
The horse cavalry.
So Bill spent the war stateside then.
Uh-huh.
Well, you weren't worried about your husband getting killed. That was a big plus.
That was a good plus.
Well, how was housing and the prices of things then?
Well, I was living with folks. They came down after we were married. I was living with you and Liz.
Me and Liz was all living together. Yeah, that little old apartment.
Well, tell us about that. That's an interesting thing. Do you want me to pause this while you take a break, John?
I don't want you to help with my memory.
I'm going to stand up here to rest my old.
Okay.
When I came to Harlingen, John and Liz had an apartment together because they had come down before separately. And so when I came down, there was the three of us. And then when he left for the Army, I don't remember if it's on or up.
Oh, it's on.
What were the things that we couldn't get?
Oh, man.
Cigarettes and sugar and...
Meat.
Meat.
Couldn't get, I don't know, they said you couldn't get the good steaks or something like that. But we didn't have any problems.
How about gasoline, you know? I mean, oh,
yeah,
cars.
Gasoline, yeah. That was another plus of Dad working at the airbase. If we could get gas, of course, we only had one car, didn't we?
Well, you had mine and then...
They didn't come down until after we were married.
You had that old car that I left behind.
Yeah.
38 Chevy.
Well, tell me about this little apartment, or these little apartments you all lived in. What were these like?
Well, it was an upstairs apartment in a big house, and the, what was it, two-room, one-bedroom and
bathroom.
Bathroom, hall, and a little kitchen at the end. It's upstairs, and we'd go out into the hall, and there's a little room over there. Who lived there? One of the daughters of the woman that lived downstairs, Miss Holmes, remember that? We were living at Mrs. Holmes when I lived down.
And her husband was, and son, they were rodeo people.
Oh.
And they was gone about half the time.
Oh, but, I didn't know that, see, because y'all had lived there for a while before I came down.
So all of you living in the same apartment or different apartments in the same building?
No, we all lived in the same apartment.
Okay.
We just had two beds.
Yeah.
Okay. I slept in. One bed over there on Washington Street, the bed was too short, and I pulled a chair up to the end of it so I could put my feet into it.
Oh, yeah. We moved over there later.
Yeah.
First we were at Miss Holmes, and then we moved to this other apartment. And it was upstairs, too. And
that didn't bother us then, but boy, it would have got me now. And was a communal bathtub, didn't it? Didn't the two apartments upstairs there on
Washington?
On Jackson Street. Then the other apartment used the same bathroom.
Oh, yeah.
I had an athlete's foot infection in my one foot, and I had to take a bath with my foot out of the water.
Oh!
I'd like to
see that. And you had athlete's foot just on one foot, huh?
Yeah.
You literally had athlete's foot.
I did. That infected, man. Damn, did something else.
I can remember the things that were rationed, that were hard to get. Sugar, gasoline. But the Army's what did Bill in, because he had an operation that the guy wasn't a surgeon. And that essentially killed his kidneys right then. But they failed completely until 1973.
Uh-huh.
But it got him in the end. But let's see, what else did we do without? But then he got a discharge, found a partial disability. What else did you want to know?
What I want to know is I was trying to get a feel for the time. You know, like when you woke up every day, did you have a telephone, or was there just like a telephone in the house, no telephone? Did you have to go use your neighbor's telephone? And how many other people had telephones? How hard was it to communicate with your friends, family members in different places, that type of thing?
We didn't have a telephone.
No.
There for a long time.
But Liz was working for Sears and Roebuck then, wasn't she?
Mm-hmm.
And then I had been there just a little while when I got the job with Dr. Schaefer. And so we always went to work, got up in the morning, dressed and went to work.
The communication with the family back north, we just wrote letters.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if we ever did make a telephone call, because we didn't have a telephone. And out in the country, when I was living out in Hardin Ranch with Uncle Lee, they didn't have a telephone out there.
How about your clothes? I mean, like, were you able to, like, buy store-bought clothes during this time? Or did you have to, like, just make do with what you had, patch stuff up? Or could you get new shoes?
I guess so, because I've always been a shoe lover.
If you hadn't gotten them, you'd remember that, huh?
I just don't remember.
Well, they said they had problems kinda getting shoes, particularly men.
Yeah.
Because all the manufacturers were manufacturing shoes for the Army.
Of course, when we got married, it was in the middle of the war, 1942.
Well, things didn't start getting plentiful until about 46.
Yeah. Well, we went through the Depression, so we had always done without.
Uh-huh. Didn't seem like anything new then, did it?
Didn't seem like anything new.
Yeah.
Of course, I started out working for Dr. Schaefer I got $10 a week, and I finally got up to $12. Or was that $12 a month, probably, wasn't it? Because we could go to a drugstore there on Main Street and get a great big chicken fried steak for 25 cents. You missed those.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man.
And the prices were really low. Like I said.
So what kind of soft drinks did you have then? You had, like, I guess Coca-Cola was there.
Yeah.
Did you have 7-Up and, you know, the other majors? Or there were no, non-returnable bottles. Everything you had to take back.
Yeah, right. Only came in glass bottles.
Yeah. What do you got? 2 cents? Refund?
Yeah. 2 or 3 cents.
Take the
bottles back. Well, I'm sure things got plentiful in 46, because then you had all the Army surplus stuff. You know, I remember even in the 60s, which would have been, you know, like 20 years later, you could still go down to the Army surplus store. And at that time, they were still overstocked with all this old World War II stuff.
Yeah.
I actually bought a bolt-action rifle from World War I that my dad and I each got one, and we kind of like made them more modern together, sort of a little project. But when I opened mine up, it still had the Cosmoline in the barrel. The thing had been manufactured back in World War I. It never been fired. Never had been fired. And that was still Army surplus in the middle 60s. So two world wars produced a massive amount of surplus, and it took us, you know, literally a couple of decades or so to work through.
Yeah.
See,
they're talking about rifles. After we got rid of the 1903 Springfield, we got out there in the Mojave Desert. They decided I needed a Browning automatic rifle, so they saddled me with that for a few months until we started to go overseas. And I had that, and they saddled me up with 240 rounds of ammunition and this VAR, and I carried that around out there in the desert for I don't know how long until, well, we started to go overseas, and I checked that in, and they gave me $1,000 until we got to Hawaii. Well, I had that until we... went down to Okinawa. I had that for several years. Never did.
We were all living in Washington, the Washington apartment, when you went.
Yeah, when I lived.
When you left.
I don't know when we moved over there from Jackson Street.
I don't think that.
But that Jackson Street address.
And I know you were gone when John and Bill and I started dating. And...
was the big Baptist church built in that, where that house used to be.
We went together about 6 months, from November to April. And then after that, he got discharged in 43, I guess. Can't remember. We started our family in 1944.
Would you, what you went from there to where?
He got a discharge, we went back to Pampa, Texas, because he had worked in the oil fields in a carbon black plant. because he couldn't do that work either. They finally gave him a military discharge, a medical discharge, because he couldn't ride horses anymore. And they put him in the EMPs, and he couldn't do that work either, so they gave him partial disability discharge. And so we went back to Pampa up by Amarillo. He couldn't do that work, so he had to quit that. And then we left Pampa, but Wayne was born while we were up there. We did a lot of doing without him there, too.
Well, what year did Bill join the Border Patrol?
45, I guess.
Okay. And where did you go first?
Well, let's see. We went... he was sent... I remember now. He was sent to Hebronville, up out in the middle of nowhere in...
Oh, what state?
Next to Laredo.
Okay, this is in Texas, okay.
Yeah, fairly close to Laredo. And but he had... He quit that after he'd been there about 6 months and went up to, they sent him up to Seattle or somewhere in Washington. Uh-huh. That's when they got back in the Border Patrol. And they sent him to Montana. And that's when we ended up in Montana, because that was in that district. But he was able to be reinstated.
So that's when you wound up, you know, like freezing to death while Bill guarded us from the Canadians.
Yeah.
Okay.
When did he learn all his Spanish?
Well, they sent him to school when he joined the Border Patrol. Well, he was in the El Paso school for 2-3 months, learned Spanish. And I stayed with Mother and Liz at that time, or Mother and Dad and Liz, and they were all living in, because they came down, Mother and folks, and Mother and Dad, Harry and John, Harry and Bob, came down in
42,
right after we'd gotten married. I was so mad, but anyway, that's, I'll put that in. They didn't know that we were getting married, or anyway. So I was living with them, with Jack Wayne, and I was pregnant before he left. I was pregnant with Betty Ann. So she was born. And after he was reinstated in Montana, I was 7 months pregnant with her. I had to move up there, or else I wouldn't have been able to go on. And so she was born up there in Montana. And then those were the toughest years of my life. Nancy was born there. Betty Ann was born 1 January, and Nancy was born the next January, 44, 46, and 47. And then he was going on detail quite a bit, and I'll never forget. Wayne and I were there, and I was very pregnant with Betty Ann. And he was gone at Christmas time on detail regarding the Japs in Spokane or somewhere over on the coast. And I went to the doctor and I said, my husband is on detail. I'm going to have this baby next month. Now, what shall I do? So they got him sent home. And the guy that got sent to take his place was very upset that we didn't care.
Yeah.
Well, y'all lived in Shelby then.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
For 4 long years we were up there.
In 1948, my wife and I and my younger brother, Harry, went up there to visit.
Yes.
I had a brand new car, bought me a brand new Plymouth. And we went up there latter part of September, or middle of September. We were there about a week, and Dad and Mother, Liz, and Bob. Did Bob come?
Harry.
Harry came with me.
Okay, well, Bob.
Yeah. He came a week later, so we all had a family reunion there in Shelby, Montana.
Oh. Phil was there. By that time, we had gotten a house that had room for...
Uh-huh. Shelby, he wasn't married then. No, not 48. He didn't get married until 50-something.
Bob?
Yeah. But anyhow...
We lived there in that little apartment at first. We had to share the bathroom. There's apartment on this side, apartment on that side, and the bathroom was in the middle. It was the worst years of my life. had this baby, going to be pregnant half the time. And then he was sent to on detail, and I would have to put the kid, they had two babies and a baby buggy, and Wayne was going on, holding on to the side, and I'd go up about, oh, as far as from here to the mailbox, order groceries, and then they would deliver them, luckily. Of course, we had no car the whole time we were up there. Those were the good old days. But if you...
And had the, what, 11 months of winter in July.
Yeah.
Or August.
11 months of winter in July, huh?
Couple of days in August. No, summer was a couple of days in August.
Uh-huh.
And I was very glad when we finally got... Then we were sent back to the valley.
Yeah, I guess you went to Mercedes from there.
Yes.
Yeah, tell us about the hell holes you lived in.
Well, one thing about it, don't have to worry about going to hell, because I already lived in Yuma, Arizona for 8 years. 8 years in the hot River Grande Valley.
These are days before air conditioning. When it was hot, it was hot.
Yes, it was hot.
Yeah.
4 years now. Well, in Yuma, Arizona, we had water coolers on top of the house.
Uh-huh.
So that was sometimes... we went from there, well, came back from Yuma, from Montana to
Mercedes.
Yeah, the valley first. We spent that 8 years there. The kids were up in, the older children were up in elementary school pretty well. We started over. I had Fred and Bonnie there in Mercedes. Then we got sent to Yuma, because Yuma, Bonnie was 6 months old before I could finally go out there. He was, he went out there a little bit beforehand. So we spent 8 years in Yuma. That was a hell hole. Don't have to worry about that next one.
When,
and then 4 years in Tucson.
What year was it that he had his heart attack out in the desert, Bill?
I don't remember. No, we were living in Tucson then.
Yeah.
Yeah, Tucson. So that had to be, we left Yuma and '60s or '60s sometime. Yeah, he did. And then we went to Tucson, and he was patrolling down on the border, and was in a gully or a wash, they called him. He had a heart attack. And he was able to call on the radio, and they came and got him. And that was a scary time of life. And I spent 4 years in Tucson.
Mm-hmm.
And then they sent us to, finally he got a promotion, got sent to Laredo. We spent 4 years there until his kidneys finally failed completely in 1973. But he had a year's, he had a, almost a year's sick leave, so that he was not working, but he was still drawing pay. And those were the good old days.
Yeah.
And when his kidneys failed in 73, we drove to San Antonio and back for dialysis twice a week, leaving at 3:30 in the morning, getting home at 5:30 of that next afternoon, or that afternoon. And we did that, and then finally we got our own machine, and I started doing the dialysis, and that's when we had to move up here, because it was too far down there for anybody to come and help us. And I was always scared, you know, and things would break and the blood would be flying all over. And he'd say, now, Ma, don't get excited. Just do so and so.
He called you Ma?
Sometimes. Yeah. Now, Ma, don't get excited. Just do so and so. And we stopped the blood from jumping up. I'll never forget we were doing that in here. That's the reason we bought this house, because it had a French drain outside to stop the driveway for the machine could be
discharged.
Discharged into it. And then they could go call people from the vet's hospital to come and help us when things broke. Or if he passed out on that time or two after we got off the machine.
When you say this house, you're talking about the house here at Canyon Lake.
Yes, yes. Okay. It moved up here.
119 Cliffwood.
Yeah.
Canyon Lake, Texas.
Right. Okay. I came up and looked. We had to be closer to the hospital. And one of the operators that were there lived up here. And he said, "Now, Pat, you're in Arkansas. You're born up there in those old mountains up there, just south of Missouri." And he thought, funny. And he said, "Do you need to move up to Canyon Lake? Because that'd be like the hill country, a lot like Arkansas was, where he came from." And Bill did love it 2 years a week. So we moved here in 75, and he died in 78. And that's bad. It's all the good parts of my life. The bad parts.
Okay, well, we've been over a lot of ground here. We're down to a point now we can start beginning to wrap this up as we're sitting here. Is there anything else that struck you that doesn't even have to be on a particular subject, just something that you'd like to be recorded? You might think that, well, this audio could well be played by your descendants 100 years from now. So just thinking about what you would like to say across a century to people. You know, I mean, years after everybody at this table is gone, what would you like them to take from the time that you've lived, values or things that you've learned that you'd like to pass on and just say so, or just things that you consider to be important that you'd pass on if you could? This is the chance to do it.
Well, I think the love and compassion and the wonderful parents that we had, for one thing, and our raising all although we had not a lot of money, and we did without things, but we learned to cope and to
share and everything else. And we came from big families, and their descendants came from big families. But now the now generation has cut down to 2 and 3 and 4 mostly in people's lives. They don't raise big families like they used to.
I tried to raise my children the same way that our parents raised us. And I think I did a pretty good job. I think we did. Because Bill was a stern parent. He said if he said something, the kids knew that he meant it. And we never punished them badly, you know, beat them up or anything like that.
I think y'all did great work, because I've met all your family and I like everybody in it. I enjoy hanging out with y'all.
Thank you.
You look like you had a thought there, John, but you kind of put it away. You want to bring it back?
No, I just didn't really have anything really.
I think that looking back at my grandparents and our parents and all of the different families, I always felt bad about Aunt Liz that she never
got married and had a family.
I remember one thing when my grandpa died. He died down in Texas. They brought him back to Missouri. And I was, 3 or 4 years old, and sad.
Yeah.
What'd
you say,
1924? Well, I guess I was 3.
About 4 or 5.
They brought him back to Missouri, and they had his casket in the bedroom of Aunt Matt's,
oh, yeah.
Henderson's, his sister.
Well, that's where they took grandmother, Kramer, buried back there.
Yeah.
And I went back there with him, with the body.
And they raised me up so I could look in and see Grandpa. And being 3 or 4, you know, I never forgot that.
Yeah.
But they wanted us to know who he was, you know, because they had left in Missouri in 1921.
Uh-huh.
All of the family except Well, there was one aunt, another aunt that had married, and my dad was the oldest, and he had married and had children. And so we really didn't know any of the other aunts and uncles until we moved to Texas. But they all turned out pretty good, too.
Yeah.
Herman, some of them kind of drank a little bit much.
Yeah.
They better drink a little bit too little.
Yeah, that's right.
Of course, this uncle of mine that sent me the money to, in 1937, I got the letter and a $20 check from him. In July of 1937, right, I hadn't been out of school very long, and I was wanting to pack up my stuff and go, come to Texas right then. No, mother said you can't make it. It'll take 3 or 4 days to get your clothes ready. Well, hell, I didn't have any clothes to put together. I had one suitcase and a pair of work gloves and a whole pair of work shoes, and few khaki clothes and some overalls, shirts, and I threw everything in there in this bag, and it just rattled around. And now it takes 10 vans to move everything I got.
Yeah.
Did you go down on the bus like I did?
I tried to go on the bus and carry them. Somebody took me down there and got me on the bus. And it took me 2 or 3 days to come.
Oh,
carried down through Oklahoma. And that was the worst bus ride I think I ever took, the first bus ride I ever took.
I remember when we were going through Oklahoma looking for, I said, "Why see any Indians?" And this girl that was sitting beside me on the bus said, "I'm an Indian." She said, "Did you expect to see them in blankets and
yeah. Well,
GPs?" And I said, "Well, I guess so." That was embarrassing.
When I was first in the Army, and they sent us from Port Sam out to the West Coast, we stopped at the train stop somewhere in New Mexico or Arizona. I don't remember. But they had a big rain and a washout, and they washed some of the track out. And so we had to stay there for, became a couple of days or something like that before we could go on. And in some little town, and they, I noticed the old Indian gals, women, sitting out alongside the by the railroad station, and old bucks with, they had their hats on and the feathers sticking up in them, and that's the way we thought about them.
That's what I was expecting.
I had no idea of seeing something like that, but later on, when my wife and I used to travel out through the West, Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, and all up through Idaho, and Montana, and through there, seeing Indian, we go through the Indian reservations, and that's the way they dress.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Let's see, what else did you want? I think we better knock this off. We gotta get that roasting.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, this has been an interview with Mary Kramer Battenfield and John Kramer regarding their lives. This will be posted with all your other paraphernalia and family information. And I want you to know it's been a pleasure talking to both of you.
Well, I hope it was coherent.
I'm not a very